Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. There's this guy down Newfane Way. He releases a new book every year, a gripping murder mystery. That would be enough for me, but he's also a death investigator for Vermont's Office of the Chief Medical Examiner, and he's a detective for the Windham County Sheriff's Office. I'm already tired thinking about how this guy keeps us all up. I want to hate him, but his books are pretty great. They follow the exploits of Detective Joe Gunther, mostly set in the southeast corner of our state. This human dynamo is Archer Mayer, and welcome to Vermont Viewpoint, Archer Mayer.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be on.
Oh, it's great to have you.
Too. In full disclosure, though, I have to point out that I'm retired as a law enforcement officer, however. I cherish those years, but they're behind me now. So I just do the medical examiner work and, of course, the writing that keeps you up at night, I hope.
You slacker.
Oh, no. It's true.
Oh,
I look back
great.
At the old days when I had three pagers on my belt and three full-time jobs simultaneously, and I do feel like a slacker. You know? I'm sitting around all day just, you know, cat.
Oh, that's wild. Hey, listeners, if you'd like to ask a question or have a comment for Archer Mayer or about any of the Joe Gunther books, there are now 31, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. How is Joe Gunther these days?
Well, of course, he's unkillable, for one thing, which
that's
is
right.
good. It's good for my employment. And the other thing is, of course, this is an aging writer's sweetest revenge. He never gets older.
Oh, yeah. How nice.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Way to go, Joe. Yeah. If you can do that for me, you know, feel free.
I know. I was about to say, you and I may be utterly startled by the man who looks back at us in the mirror, but in our brains, of course, that guy doesn't exist.
That's
nor
right.
Nor does he for Joe.
That's so true. Ever so true. Where did the idea for Joe Gunther come from in the first place?
He actually came from sort of a multiplicity of places. One is terribly pragmatic. I wanted to make a living as a writer, which is kind of like wanting to survive a jump out of an airplane because the finances of being a full-time writer are ridiculous. But if you want to get into the double digits, and by that I mean $10,000 a year on up, you probably want to write popular fiction and detective fiction and series, regional detective fiction. Back in the 80s when I was envisioning all this, seemed to be the way to go. So that was reason number one. Now, that's just nuts and bolts so that I can put tofu on the table. But more to the point, and what I quickly discovered was that I had inadvertently given birth to a career that has sustained me ever since, because by writing about the same people, the same area, Vermont,
yep,
the same cultural anthropological things that fascinate me and that are increasingly important to our country, just listening to your news feed before we began as evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
I began to realize, you know what, I've just latched on to something that will sustain me for the rest of my life. I talk about people in crisis. Well, guess what, folks? We're in crisis all the time. And so Joe Gunther was created as a sort of moral compass point. The man is astonishingly straightforward, level-headed, a team player, thoughtful, kind, etc. In other words, he's a Boy Scout and boring as hell. But if you surround him with enough lunatics, and it turns out I have done so,
yes,
then you can be diverted by the activities of the rest of us, where Joe will hold the moral center. He's kind of like the keel of the boat,
yeah,
and he's the person other people can go to when they get into a real tangle and they sort of say, it's kind of like Mr. Rogers in a way, only he carries a gun. And that's very useful to me as a device.
How much of Archer Mayer's DNA is there in Joe Gunther?
Well, yeah, I have a rather acerbic, skeptical daughter who lives in Philadelphia as a librarian nowadays, and she said, "So, Dad, are they just still asking you how much Joe Gunther is there in you?" And I went, "Oh yeah." The question comes up reasonably enough, and she shook her head and said, "Am I the only one on the earth who knows you're really Willie Kunkel?"
Now, oh, man.
In fairness, A, she's accurate, and so I couldn't hold it against her. And B, I have to point out for those who have no idea who I am and what we're talking about, that Willie Kunkel is one of the more fractured and yes, curiously messed up individuals in this series of books. But he does have a heart of gold. He has a curious way of expressing it oftentimes, but his heart's in the right place, and Joe, therefore, keeps him employed as a cop, despite the fact that any other boss would probably have fired him about 30 books ago.
Yeah, I do. Willie Kunkel's pretty interesting because he takes an approach to questioning people that is unlike anybody else. And and Joe wants to stop him, but he knows he's going to get the answers. So I'll give him a little bit more, you know, leeway, a little bit more rope as he's interviewing somebody, right?
Yes, Joe's got a funny role to play there because he can't sustain or allow anything illegal. So he's got the law parked in his head, right. And when he looks at Willie, that's the guide that he applies. Is it rude? Yeah, probably. Right. Is it confrontational? Yeah, definitely. Is it controversial? Probably. But is it illegal? And if it's not illegal, if it'll hold up in court, if the state's attorney can run with it, Joe will usually go, okay, Willie. And on the other side, if Willie's on his own, I'm just bringing in results, Joe sometimes kind of doesn't want to know how he got those results. And so they've come to a middle ground of getting things done.
You mentioned Joe Gunther's kind of boring, kind of a Boy Scout. Is there anything, you've been living with him now for 30-odd years, is there anything that bothers you about Joe Gunther?
You know, actually not. I really like the guy. I would like to think that when I wake up in the morning and crawl out of bed, that I could have a whole day just like Joe Gunther, being thoughtful and supportive of my fellow human beings and kindly disposed. And if anything, he has taught me things. I'm becoming, or I'm trying to become, more like Joe Gunther as I age, which is really quite bizarre when you realize you've created, out of whole cloth, a fictional character who is now beginning to influence your life in a positive way. And indeed, I've even softened Willie Kunkel over the years as I've come to realize the sagacity of Joe's approach to life. He's slow to anger. He's slow to judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a lot of things that could stand us in good stead nowadays. So in a funny kind of way, he's become an enriching inspiration rather than something that's made me restless over the years.
One of the things, one of the lines on your resume is that you're a death investigator, which is one of the most interesting job titles I've ever heard. So what exactly does a death investigator do?
Well, it's interesting. They call us assistant medical examiners. And so when you parse that out, as you would if you write books like I do, that tells you precisely nothing. What do I read? Medical books? You know, it doesn't make any sense. Funnily enough, we are all board certified, the state of Vermont. I'm here to comfort people, by the way, by saying that the medical examiner system in the state of Vermont ranks among the very best in the nation. Mm-hmm. It is a requirement of our office that every investigator be board certified. That's extremely rare in this country. But what that means is, and I just came off shift at 7 o'clock this morning, and I did seven calls last week, so it's been a busy week. What that means is that when people are found dead in whatever environment, and it is unclear as to what happened, they call us. We come in along with law enforcement and with consultation with the state's attorney's office to determine the cause of death. Now, some of this may seem obvious to you. You know, there's, you're 104 years old, you got a bottle of scotch in one hand and a carton of cigarettes in the other. Well, golly gee, I wonder what killed you. But in fact, more than once, you know, you roll someone like that over and he has a knife in his back. Well, we are quirky human beings, and our demises are no less curious. So we need to absolutely draw a line under, as best we can, under what killed us. So if you're at home on hospice, you have a doctor in attendance, you've been diagnosed with a terminal disease, and you die, then chances are you're never going to see me, or at least the family isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because that's an attended death. It was expected. It was hands-on death, in a good way, that is. But anything shy of that, I get called in, and it's just so that we can clarify things. But more importantly, the medical examiner's office exists so that we can crunch the numbers. And everyone kind of goes, oh, God, how nerdy can you be? But in fact, when, for example, the vaccine and the pandemics that we're looking at now, all those stats, all those testings, all that, oh gosh, golly gee, the death count and whatnot, where's all that come from? Medical examiner's offices. We trace the dead, and we trace what made the dead dead. And therefore, we, in a irony, we have a finger on the pulse of what is killing Americans. And by so doing, people go to our figures to ascertain funding and policies having to do with healthcare. How do we know that before the pandemic, heart disease was one of the number one killers in the United States? Because you went to medical examiners to get that data. So it actually, funnily enough, is an extraordinarily influential office.
We're going to go right to the phones. Got Matt first in Northfield. Matt, go right ahead.
Well, good morning, Arthur. This is Matt Bean and Cherie. You used to come to the Terry Lodge in Isle of Mont with our dear friend Eric Buell and have dinner, and you'd give us a little chat. And that was a few years ago, but we enjoyed your company very much.
Oh, you're very kind to say that, Matt. And Eric, who has sadly been taken by cancer not too terribly long ago, was a long-lived and cherished friend, and I'm delighted that you brought up his name. Wonderful guy.
Matt, thanks for calling. And let's go to Nola, who's calling from Ripton. Nola, go right ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was all set to head out to the greenhouse out of another foot of snow, and I heard that you were going to be on, and I thought, wait, stop. And so I was calling primarily to say thank you for your books, and it's so good to get connected back to Vermont when reading your books. I know that place.
Yes.
I know that place. It's a wonderful feeling. And so I would invite you to consider using Ripton as a location for one of your upcoming books.
All right.
You want me to kill a few people in Ripton? Okay.
No. We don't have to kill anyone.
Make a note to self.
We'll go after people that are already gone. And one brief noticement. So my beloved mother-in-law, and I'm not saying that sarcastically, has a passion for Louise Penny books.
Mm-hmm.
And she sent us one, and then two, and then three. And your books, so the book I'm reading right now, which I think is your latest one, it's called Bomber's Moon.
That's the one before.
Okay. Yep. So in the book, Joe and his friends have eaten Dunkin' Donuts, drunk some coffee, and that's about it. When you read Louise books, you don't get past the first chapter without them having, some French dish and consommé.
Well, one is...
I love the difference.
Yeah.
Keep these guys on their Dunkin' Donuts diet, and she'll keep the other ones where they're at.
I used to threaten people that when I write a true knockdown, multi-million-dollar bestseller, it's going to be called The Joe Gunther Cookbook.
There you go.
It'll be the shortest book I ever wrote.
Well, one thing I have to kind of take off on with Nola is the fact that you do set it in real Vermont towns. There are books where, you know, they'll kind of create a fictional town and you know where it is, but you live right amongst these towns, and I'm thinking, boy, you know, like in The Orphan's Guilt, the most recent book, you give a little stick to Springfield, for instance, and but you're not afraid to kind of call them out, you know, and you put things right in Vermont and tell it like it is, and I kind of love that about the Gunther series.
It was my intention from the get-go, Rick, to make Vermont and its towns and areas characters,
yeah,
as real and as three-dimensional as the human beings in the books.
I think you do that very well. We got a lot of calls, so I'm going to try to get them all in. Fred's calling now from Montpelier. This is great. Fred, go right ahead. You there, Fred? Fred in Montpelier? Hold on, Fred. There you go. Go ahead, Fred.
I've read all your books, and I can't wait till the next one keep coming out. And the new one I got for Christmas, I had to read John Grisham first, I hate to say.
I can stand the company.
All right.
Yeah, but I spent a few years in the ski industry. My favorite one was Tucker Peak, and you were right on about the goings-on within a ski area.
That's great.
Oh, here's a wonderful story about that. I do a lot of research when I write these books. I interview a lot of people. And usually I try to acknowledge those people in the beginning of the book. And so I filled a room with ski industry folks. And these are the nuts and bolts guys. And, you know, and we spent a very happy couple of hours together. And I had a tape recorder going and got it all down. And I said, well, guys, you know, I can't pay you. I don't pay anybody. I'm a writer. I make ends meet. But I'd love to acknowledge you in the book. And they all looked at each other and looked at me and went, no. None of us, not a single person wanted to appear as a thank you or anything else.
Oh, I love it. All right, let's go back.
I did get it right.
Well done. Yeah, I agree. All right, let's take Lonnie from Barrie. Hi, Lonnie. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
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 Mr. Mayor, could you tell a quick story about how you became aware and involved in thermal imaging cameras?
Mm. Well, actually, funnily enough, I'm also on the fire department. I'm now on the board of trustees, but I used to run the rescue truck for many decades, and I was an interior attack firefighter for that period of time as well. I'm too old and probably too much of a threat to throw into a burning building now, but in those days, thermal cameras had just started to get introduced, so I pushed my way around a little bit, and we got a display model of a sort of sales guy's model, one of the very first handheld ones, and I think we were the first, if not the first, among one or two of the very first Vermont departments, volunteer or professional, to have such a device online in service. And we did that so many years ago, I can't even remember it. So that's my familiarity with thermal imaging dates way back to that. And, of course, we used it in law enforcement as well and other capacities. Very useful devices.
I think you also became aware, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but you became aware of T.H. White, the author of The Once and Future King, and the lost volume, Book of Merlin.
That's correct, Rick. Back in the 1970s, I was working as a scholarly editor for the University of Texas Press. in homage to my nerdy upbringing and past. As part and parcel of that, I dug around in archives that were filled with millions and millions of manuscripts that the University of Texas has purchased in England. And among them was a manuscript that had never been published, which was to be included in the Once and Future King, but never was. And the reason it wasn't is because it's a pacifist conclusion to that overall work, it was going to be published near World War II. Well, of course, that was unacceptable. Pacifism was out, and now warmongering was in, and we were going to win the war, and blah, blah, blah. And so this was put on the shelf. Where I discovered it and had it cleaned up, and I found T.H. White's editing marks, and I was able to chronologically put them in order. And so we published this book called The Book of Merlin, which was to be the conclusion to The Once and Future King. It was great fun. I enjoyed it. It was, my sort of entry into literary history, and the book holds up. I'm very pleased that all my training and my scholarly background was put to at least one single use.
That is outstanding. I leave now with just about a minute left for you to tell us just a little bit about The Orphan's Guilt, which is the most recent.
The Orphan's Guilt is a story of unpacking boxes. Sometimes as a joke in Christmas, you get a big box and you open it and there's a smaller box and there's another smaller box and a smaller box and a smaller box, and then you get to the prize in the middle. The book is constructed somewhat like that.
Mm-hmm.
And The Orphan's Guilt begins very pleasantly enough. Someone's pulled over on DUI, but it's no big deal, and they get to know each other. And little by little by little, we get into why was he drunk? What were his losses? Where did he disappear to right after that drunk driving charge? And back into history, his history, the state of Vermont's history, and a variety of other things to uncover the truth behind what broke this man's heart and caused him to be pulled over in Chapter 1 for drunk driving.
And I know that Book 32 is in the works, correct?
Oh, I've actually finished it. I'm putting the last final editing touches on it, and it'll be out next fall, and it's called Marked Man.
All right. Love hearing that. All right. That is Archer Mayer, 31st book, The Orphan's Guilt, 32nd book, heading to us later this year, Marked Man. Archer Mayer, it was an absolute pleasure getting to speak with you today.
Well, Rick, it was a real honor, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. We're going to pop out for a CBS News update, then pick up the discussion. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Carl Lindholm about sports here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We are into January. Still in a pandemic, but there is hope on the horizon. At the Warren Store, renovations are wrapping up. The new deli is rocking hard with old favorites and new menu items like French fries. The grab-and-go dinners are to die for. Delicious, generous, full-course meals. Check out our website, warrenstore.com, for daily offerings. Upstairs, we have a new look in the ladies' department and, wait for it, heat and air conditioning. Still fun, friendly, and funky. Main Street, Warren Village. New hours, 7:30 to 5 o'clock daily.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. From bad guys, we now shift to baseball and other sports. Actually, the uniform numbers that we see athletes wear. We take them for granted until we're picking them out for ourselves or purchasing a replica jersey with a number on it. Then it gets really important. Some have superstitions about numbers. Others wear them because their favorites wore them at one time. Carl Lindholm is a retired dean and professor at Middlebury College. He's also an expert on Negro League baseball, and he writes an entertaining sports column for the Addison Independent. It was his recent column about sports numbers in the Addy Indy that prompted me to invite him on the program this morning. Carl, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thanks very much. Rick. It's looking out my window here on a snowy Sunday morning.
Yeah. And listeners, if you want to share a sports number story, if you've got a baseball question for Carl Lindholm, give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Carl, where did numbers on uniforms, when did that become a thing?
Well, as far as I can tell, it was pretty late. It was 1929. There were lots of experiments with numbers before that, but nothing on a very, large-scale, wholesale way. The Yankees, the New York Yankees, decided to put the numbers on the backs of their baseball uniforms of the players in the lineup, in the batting order, from 1 to 10. That's how Babe Ruth got number 3, and Lou Gehrig got number 4. And then it became pretty much the custom in Major League Baseball. Now, I can't say definitively that there were not numbers before then, but if you look at old pictures of those sports where the players wore numbers on their backs or on both sides, you'll see that football players pretty much wore jerseys without numbers.
And right.
Likewise, baseball.
Well, when we talk numbers, let's start with number 42, which is officially retired in all of Major League Baseball.
That's right. It's the only number. It's a great number. There were other great 42s. Players who were wearing 42 when Major League Baseball decided to retire numbers were allowed to keep them. And the last player to wear 42 was the great Mariano Rivera.
That's right.
Came into the Hall of Fame in the first ballot unanimously. And then the last player to wear 42 for the Red Sox was a notable player, too, and that would be Mo Vaughn.
Oh, yeah. He was a great one. We should mention that 42 was retired in all of Major League Baseball because that's the number that he wore for the Dodgers, Jackie Robinson, when he broke the color line in 1947. The reverse of that, 24, has been a really big number in sports as well.
Yes. Well, I think it. You know, it's interesting, too. There's an aesthetic to numbers. At least I felt that way when I was watching them. And twos and fours, they seem to just look good on the jersey. So you do turn around 42 and you get Willie Mays.
Yeah.
And you get Kobe Bryant. And, and Ken Griffey Jr. So I think 42 is a remarkable number because of Jackie Robinson. But I think 24, perhaps, if you had to pick out a baseball number, a great baseball number. Of course, a great baseball number, I think, would be number 9, Ted Williams.
Oh, no kidding.
He was a man when I was growing up, and he was identified by that number. But 24 is a pretty good number to have. And I think if you're a good player and you're confident in your ability, especially in baseball, Kobe Bryant, though, in basketball, but
yeah.
He wore another number, too. But 24 would be a pretty good number to take if you're a confident person.
You mentioned number 9, Ted Williams, the Splendid Splinter, Teddy Ballgame. Are there any other numbers that you really gravitate towards?
Well, you know, a couple. I can think of. How about your neighbor up there, Bill Lee?
Oh, yeah.
He wore number 37. And he wore 37 to honor a couple of players, a couple of figures in baseball, given who Bill Lee is and what his nature is.
Mm-hmm.
He picked the number of Jimmy Pearsall. So some of your old-timers who are listening will remember Jimmy Pearsall, really pretty much a terrific center fielder
mm-hmm.
for the Red Sox, but he was deviled by mental illness.
Yeah.
And a biography by Hal Hirschberg was written called Fierce Strikes Out, which was something of a hit during its time. And then also, Casey Stengel wore 37.
Oh.
And Casey, he had a pretty remarkable identity, too, as a kind of a character in baseball. Managed great Yankee teams and terrible Mets teams.
That's right.
But had his own language called Stengelese. So Bill Lee liked 37 to honor those guys. And then, of course, Carlton Fisk, if you're a New Englander, had number 27 for the Red Sox, and they've retired that number, and then they had turned it around and were number 72 for 12 years for the White Sox. And Actually, he went into the Hall of Fame with his Red Sox hat, of course.
But he played more years with the White Sox.
Yeah, he did. Isn't that interesting?
And, yeah.
You know, he was born in Vermont.
That's right. In Brattleboro?
I think Bellows Falls.
Or Bellows Falls. I think was his 72 retired by the White Sox?
I believe he's had both numbers retired.
Yeah.
Both numbers, yeah.
Now, another number that's kind of special in college football is number 22. You remember that one?
22 with the Emmett Smith?
No, it probably was at Florida, but he was with the Cowboys. But 22 in college football was none other than Doug Flutie as a quarterback.
Oh. Sure, okay.
Yeah, and he couldn't wear it in the pros. He had to wear two. Most of the time in the pros.
Yes, that's what I remember.
Yeah. So, but he was 22 when at Boston College. I was living down in Miami at the time of that incredible throw. So it'll always stick in my mind. And that was just one of those moments in sports that that really stick with you. Now, you checked. Go ahead.
You remember, you know, Flutie is a favorite of yours.
Mm-hmm.
So. You remember his number. I think it's remarkable that we identify, you know, these. It's remarkable, especially if you go back a way. Now with all these merchandise branding opportunities, players really take advantage of getting their gear sold.
Yeah.
But you know, it's interesting. You do remember. You remember who these, because it's your identity on the field. Your number is your identity. You know, foul on number 10, or you go home and say, boy, that number 12 for them could really play.
Right, you do that,
it's your identity. You know, who are you? Well, I'm number 10.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking of QBs. You know, in my youth, I'm thinking of 19 Johnny Unitas, 5 Roman Gabriel, 12 was Bob Greasy. There aren't many 13s, but I think Dan Marino for the Dolphins was a 13, and a great one. So. Not a triskaidectaphobic, apparently. All right.
Oh, good. No, you got to at least mention number 12 because he had such a great game last night. Played a long time for the Patriots, and now he's
well
for the Florida team. And, I think,
TB12.
Brady, of course, he represents the commercial exploitation of your number because he's constantly flogging his TB12. You know, Joe Namath was number 12.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. That's right.
Harry Bradshaw.
So. Yeah. Oh, there's some good ones. All right, we're going to take a call. Cindy is joining us from North Facetown. Cindy, go right ahead.
Hi, you guys. Thank you for your show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm calling. I was just listening, and I was wondering if all those numbers, they seem to have 3 syllables.
Oh.
You know, I wondered if that played into it. And then the other thing is, I have a family number. It has nothing to do with baseball. I grew up in the Midwest, and we sailed on a lake, you know, competitive sailing, and our number was 9. My family was 9.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that's how we were determined. You know, other families were 15, you know, 18, but we were 9. So
oh, I love it.
Whenever I hear the number 9, I say, oh, that's my family number.
Isn't that incredible, Carl? You know, and you said 9, and you equate it to Ted Williams, one of the greatest players of all times. And Cindy hears 9 and thinks, oh, that's my family number, sailing out there on the lake.
Was it 9 because it was on the boat? How did it derive from in sailing?
Oh, well, you were identified, say we were V9, even though the lake I grew up on was began with a P, but I guess that was already taken. So if we were V9 and say Lake LaBelle was another one, or, you know, out there in Wisconsin, you're all identified by what lake you're from, mm-hmm. not what town are you from.
And would that be on your sail or on your boat, Cindy?
Oh, yeah.
Or?
Oh, yeah. Sailboat racing. It was a competitive, you know, all sorts, or many, many fleets.
Cutboats,
you know, up to A boats, 30 foot long. You know, my dad had a crew of like 8 men that had to sail the boat. And
wow.
Yeah. So anyway, I just I related to the number thing.
I love it. That's great, Cindy. Thank you. Well, Carl, one thing you did was you checked. We're talking so much about male athletes, and you made sure to see if female athletes place the same importance on their uniform numbers. We just heard from Cindy. Definitely, her family did. What did you find?
Well, it's interesting, Rick. I wrote the whole column. And then I looked at it and said, oh, my daughters are going to kill me. There's not a single woman. And I said, well, that must be because, you know, women don't care about their numbers. They just take the number of the jersey that they're handed. And I said, well, women don't play football, and that's a sport that's often, you know, that has had numbers for years. Baseball, likewise. I don't know if softball players, you know, there's no professional softball league, so numbers don't stand out particularly there. But I said, if I don't at least check on this, you know, I'm going to be in trouble at home. And so I wrote to three of the women coaches at Middlebury College, and I said, and I sort of presented it that way. I said, do women really care about what number they wear? And oh my goodness, I got a response that said, you bet they do. they really care, and they have a lot of good reasons. And usually, what I did find out that was interesting, the most best-selling Nike jerseys last year were two women, Megan Rapinoe of the women's national soccer team, and Ionescu, Sabrina Ionescu, the great basketball player from Oregon, who was the number one draft pick in the WNBA.
Oh,
but a lot
so
of the athletes at Middlebury, they picked numbers because they had a sibling had it, or maybe a parent, a dad perhaps had a number that was of particular importance. But what we found at Middlebury, these great women athletes who had become coaches, is they generally arbitrarily received the number early in their career, and they kept it, and it became their number. So, and then the interesting thing was I talked to Kate Perrine Lizzy, the national championship coach of the women's lacrosse team, and she picked number 10 as her favorite number because she had a brother, I believe, who played soccer, and number 10 in soccer is the number of the greatest players who ever played the game, Pele and Maradona and so forth. And it also, I didn't know this when I wrote the column, it reflects a position on the field. The positions are numbered, and players often are given a jersey with a number of their position on the field, and 10 is an attacking midfielder. So I learned that. But women care a lot about their numbers.
We're talking about athletes' numbers with Carl Lindholm, who writes a sports column in the Addison Independent. We'll also talk Red Sox, Negro League Baseball, and if you want to join the conversation, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Carl, there was a time, one thing that your column taught me about, there was something about college and high school basketball numbers that I never knew before I read your column. So tell people about that.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You'll never see on a high school or a college basketball team the numbers 6, 7, 8, or 9. And you'll see them in the pros. You know, Bill Russell is number 6 famously. And the reason is the official, the referee, cannot form those numbers on one hand. And so in the din of a high school gymnasium or a college gymnasium, when the official goes over to the scorer's table and says foul is on number 27, how do you do that?
Right.
On one hand, you've got what do you say, 5 and 2 is set. Well, you need 3 hands to get one. So you can't do it. So those numbers are illegal. You see them again, in the pros, and often in, you know, the people who order uniforms for kids basketball will not be aware of that, and you don't have to worry about noisy gyms. But
right.
Yeah, those numbers are illegal in school sports.
And right now, we don't have to worry about noisy gyms for a while in any competitions, alas. Now, I know you're an expert on Negro League baseball and really love it like I do. Recently, I think the majors accepted the Negro League stats. So what are your thoughts about that?
I think it's good. I think it's complicated. What I hope it does is bring attention to the Negro League baseball in a kind of a cultural sense. I have had a chance over time to teach a course on race and baseball, which is generally focuses on the Negro Leagues. Because during segregation, from 1880s to 1950s, during segregation, there was a very vigorous culture in Black America, and baseball was one of the major industries. Baseball players and musicians were heroes of Black culture, and it's a wonderful history. I got interested in it. I don't want to go too far back because I want to talk about the stats, but I grew up in Maine and loved the Red Sox, of course, which was the last team to integrate. And Red Sox passed on Jackie Robinson in 1947, and they worked him out in Fenway Park, and they passed on Willie Mays, and because the Birmingham Black Barons, Willie was playing for them with his dad, and the Red Sox top farm team was the Birmingham Barons, played in the same park. And I ask myself and others always, I think the Red Sox would have been better in the 50s if they had Ted Williams and Willie Mays and Jackie Robinson. So I grew up interested in baseball, and then I became to maturity during the civil rights movement of Martin Luther King. Got very interested in that aspect of American history, and realized I didn't know anything about Black baseball. All the great heroes of baseball were white: Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, Walter Johnson, and there were players of that ability, as subsequent years proved. During that time, I didn't know anything about it, so it was a wonderful awakening for me to learn about the Negro Leagues. And then I still think there's great ignorance of those Negro Leagues. Once you get past Jackie Robinson and maybe Satchel Paige, even writers and ball players don't know much about the Negro Leagues. So, getting to the stats, I'm sorry to go on and on, but getting to the stats, I think it's very good. But you have to understand that the Negro League teams, the Negro League players, the Black players, they played year-round. They played in Cuba in the winter, and they played hundreds and hundreds of games during a year. You know, Satchel Paige estimated that he pitched, hundreds, 200 no-hitters and over 1,000 wins. Well, they would come and play, the Burlington Cardinals if they could get a payday out of it.
So right.
They only played in their five different seven different Negro Leagues from 1920 to 1948. And those stats will count the league games when the Negro American League played, for example, the Negro National League in the Negro Major Leagues. Those stats will count. But there'll be lots of statistics that don't apply. So it's a little complicated, but I think it's good. Josh Gibson is going to shoot up the ranks of the great hitters of all time.
Well done.
And there'll be a number of worthy players that will now have their names in the baseball record, the baseball encyclopedia. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing to be doing. It's complicated. But I think it's time.
Well, you said you're a big Sox fan. We only have about 30 seconds left, but thoughts about Sox in 2021, what they should do, how they'll fare, what do you think?
I think they have a pretty good core. I think Bogarts and Vasquez, and I think the new player Verdugo is a good player.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to relax a little bit. It may not be next year. It may be the year after. They have money, They're not the Tampa Bay Red Sox. They have money, and if they spend it wisely, I think they're gonna be mediocre for a very short time. I just don't even think about last summer. It was just a period of audition. So we can relax. We're going to have a good time. It'll be okay.
All right. Love to hear that. Carl Lindholm, a retired Middlebury College dean and professor, and he writes a very entertaining column for the Addison Independent. Check it out. Carl, thank you so much for being on with us.
Thank you, Rick. Have a good day.
You too. CBS News is next, and then we'll be back to learn how Vermont's bear hunting season went. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Here we are into January, still in a pandemic, but there is hope on the horizon. At the Warren Store, renovations are wrapping up. The new deli is rocking hard with old favorites and new menu items like French fries. The grab-and-go dinners are to die for, delicious, generous, full-course meals. Check out our website, warrenstore.com, for daily offerings. Upstairs, we have a new look in the ladies' department and, wait for it, heat and air conditioning. Still fun, friendly, and funky. Main Street, Warren Village. New hours, 7:30 to 5 o'clock daily.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. 2020 was a big year for Bears in several ways. One, the Chicago Bears made the NFL playoffs. There were a lot of Bear interactions in Vermont last year, and Hunters had a record season. And we're going to spend the next half hour ignoring the first item that I mentioned and spending time on the other two. Joining me now to discuss Vermont's Bears and bear hunting season is Forrest Hammond, Vermont Fish and Wildlife bear biologist. Forrest, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Listeners, you can call with your questions about the season or let us know how the season went for you. Our numbers are 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com if you'd like to do it that way. Forrest, what were the final numbers from bear hunting in 2020 in Vermont?
We had some of the highest numbers we've ever had of bears taken in 2020. 910 bears were harvested by licensed hunters this past year.
Now, out of how many bears that we have in the state?
Well, the number varies naturally from year to year. The females produce better after a good food year, and some cubs die naturally in poor food years. But we've got a population objective, which we try to manage for, of 3,500 to 5,500 bears. And we believe we've been somewhere in the middle of that number over the past few years. So somewhere less than 5,000 bears.
So the bear take this year was probably somewhere in the 20 to 25% region. So one in every four, or one in every five bears. Is that too much, not enough, just right? What do you think?
Well, it's on the high end for sure, Rick, and it's something we'll be watching. But we've had this happen before, where we'll get a couple of years of high harvest followed by low years as well. And I expect that's what will happen. If I had to predict for next year, I would say it'll probably be a low harvest next year.
Gotcha. And the number of bear hunters seemed off the charts. How many people were hunting this year for bear?
We had nearly 14,000 hunters buy bear tags this year, which was, nearly a 25% increase over last year, which probably represents the reason why an awful lot of those additional bears were taken this fall.
Right. And that spike in number of the hunting license or the for the bear hunting, you think that's COVID related or what do you think was going on there?
Yeah, we absolutely do. Our department and other states as well across the country saw a big increase in fishing and hunting license sales this past year.
When it comes to bear hunting, do you limit how many can be purchased?
We do not, and we've never had to before. Mm-hmm. In fact, we keep track of how many hunters there are, and I know that some states have worried that they don't have enough bear hunters to perhaps control the number of bears that they have. Maine is very concerned with this. Especially with the fact that most of their bear hunters are non-residents, and of course people didn't travel as much this past fall. But in Vermont, we've had we still have a strong culture of bear hunting, and so we have not worried about that at all. If we reach a point where we think too many bears will be taken, then in the past we've shortened the season, and vice versa, we've lengthened it when we wanted more bears to be taken.
And then as far as limits, and this is from someone you can tell who doesn't hunt or hunt bear in particular, is it just one bear that you're allowed to take each year?
Yes, just one bear in Vermont. Even though it's called having an early season and a late season, with the late season being the overlap with the November rifle deer season, any resident can take a bear just on their regular hunting tag. And that's why we call that the late season. But even though there are two seasons, only one bear can be taken.
Gotcha. You mentioned that our population is somewhere between 3,500 and 5,500. Is that where we want to see that number? And, you know, how is that determined? What's the right number of bear in Vermont?
Well, unlike other big game species, we actually manage for the number of bears based on what we feel is the social caring capacity, being the number of bears that the public we feel can tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
How many bears that the people want to see, with the idea that too many bears, we would have too many issues and people wouldn't want to see that. The actual number is something that we, every 10 years, we visit with our big game plan, and we go out to the public and ask them how many bears they'd like to see in Vermont, with the idea that nobody knows exactly, so it's with people's perception on whether or not they feel there's not enough bears, or they like the number, or they'd like to see more. In the last couple of 10-year plans that we've had, people have indicated that they thought the number of bears is about right, and they wanted us to try to keep the population at about the level that it is now.
Now, in Vermont, I think we only have black bears. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. We don't have any of the bigger polar bears and brown bears.
All right, that's good. What can you tell us about the habits of the black bears here in Vermont?
Well, black bear are wide-ranging animals. They're our largest carnivore that we have in the state. They are then classified as predators, even though they're not very efficient at being predators, and mostly only eat meat when they can obtain it, normally in the spring when there are fawns or moose calves perhaps available, or if they find a wounded animal or roadkill animal. Otherwise, they're not very efficient predators. And instead, they're vegetarians for the most part. All through the spring and summer, they're feeding on vegetation until the berries and nuts start arriving in late summer and into the fall. And it's at that time that the bears start putting on weight in preparation for hibernation. And also to put on enough weight for the females to be able to bear their young while in hibernation. In a period of time of up to five and a half months, when they don't eat or drink or defecate or urinate.
Now, I know seeing a bear really can freak people out. What should humans do when they encounter a black bear?
Well, we hope that people wouldn't be freaked out at seeing a bear, but unfortunately, if a person is has not seen many bears before, that often is the case. But for the most part, I think it's an experience that a person should treasure, being able to actually see such a beautiful wild animal in the state. In seeing one, if it's outside hiking on a trail, chances are that the bear will flee and they'll only catch a glimpse of that bear. Or they might encounter it when they're driving along the road and the road the bear crosses in front of them. But more and more often, people are starting to see bears coming into their backyard.
And right.
Bears' behavior has started to change where they're starting to take advantage of the numbers of people who put things that are good to eat in their backyard, especially bird seed, unsecured garbage, and now people are starting to compost.
Yeah, so is that explaining why we've seen more bear interactions in the past year?
You know, that's part of it. There's a lot of factors as to why we saw a lot more bears this past year. Probably foremost was just the fact that it was a very poor year for natural food production. There were very few apples in berries, and even the vegetation. We had a drought early in the year where the vegetation they'd normally be feeding on at that time of year dried up and was pretty unpalatable. So it had the bears searching for other types of food. And they're finding it easier and easier to find those foods in people's backyards, and more bears are learning that.
And Forrest, when will they start stirring again, coming out of hibernation, and when we should probably be taking down, like, our bird feeders?
Well, historically, our recommendation has been to take down, to take down your bird feeders around April 1st. And that still applies for the most part. But boy, with climate change and with the winter being milder and often springtime coming earlier, then we see more and more bears that are active before that time period. So what we suggest to people is when it's starting to get towards spring, if you don't have much snow on the ground and or you hear of a bear active in your neighborhood, then that's a good time to take down those bird feeders for the year.
Forrest, we're going to go to the phones. We've got Roseanne calling from Montpelier. Hi, Roseanne.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great. What's your question or comment?
Well, my question is there any restrictions on male or female as far as the bears and killing them?
Oh, great question. Thanks, Roseanne. Forrest?
That's a good question. We hear that quite often. We do not have any restrictions about hunters taking either a male or a female bear. For the most part, they look alike, and it's very difficult to tell one from the other. What we do is we make recommendations that we suggest to people if they see a group of bears that it's probably a female with young, and we recommend that they not take those bears. And the great majority of hunters would not want to shoot a female that has small cubs, and they don't.
Okay. Brenna's next, calling from Stowe. Good morning, Brenna. How are you?
Hi, good. Good morning. I have both a comment and a question.
Sure.
Hi, Forrest. I know I'm not alone in being concerned that, you know, over 20% of the bear population has been hunted and killed this year, and a lot of folks don't realize that this doesn't include bears that were killed, you know, that were deemed nuisance bears or bears that got hit by cars. So really, I'd be curious to know what the total percentage of bears who were killed in 2020 was. Also, Forrest, I'm not sure if you're aware, if you've read any of the studies, but there's been numerous research papers that have come out that have said that, you know, hunting and killing bears does not reduce future human-bear conflicts, and that the only way to really reduce human-bear conflicts is to change human behavior. So we really can't hunt and kill our way out of these conflicts. So what is the state or the department plan on doing to get tougher on the public to try and avoid, you know, people keeping bird feeders out year-round and other types of things?
All right, Brenna, great questions. Let's start, if you've got the statistics, on how many other bears are killed in the course of a year because they're nuisance bears or because they've been hit by cars. Do you know that, Forrest?
Yeah, I've got some preliminary numbers on what we call bears that are killed incidental to the hunting season. A little over 200 bears this year were killed, with the majority of those being killed in auto accidents.
Gotcha. And to Brenna's other point, you know, how do we as a state, I don't know if we can, legislate or regulate that interaction between humans and bears and do the right things as far as, you know, taking down the bird feeder, as far as not leaving trash out to make sure that the interaction between humans and bears is minimized, because I think, you know, that's probably where we lose some the quote-unquote nuisance bears, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, is that a question for me, Rick?
Yes, it is. That was the other question Brenna had.
Sure. You know, our emphasis is on public education and outreach. With the mindset that people can learn to live with bears, and bears just won't be a problem if they're not able to easily obtain human foods. Unfortunately, it's easier to work with the Bears than it is with people, and it's been very tough to get that message across with people, especially in a, knowing that the number of people feeding birds has increased over time. That's a growing hobby. There's probably more and more garbage out there in areas that bears can get it as well. And this past year just saw a large number of people attempting to compost right. that were pretty inexperienced with it, and that added to the problems. So what can we do? Can we have more legislation and rules? It's illegal now to intentionally feed bears. And if bears are coming into your backyard to get food and they continue to do that and we get a report of that, a game warden can actually come and that person can be cited, although normally they're given warnings to stop. Mm-hmm. And the reason we think it's a concern is because if one person is allowing to get a bear to get food in a neighborhood, that bear is going to go to all over the neighborhood looking for additional food. They can go up to 5 miles in a night, hitting wow. different people's backyards, looking for someone else who has bird feeders hanging out in the middle of the summer, or they put their garbage out the night before pickup instead of the morning of garbage mm-hmm. pickup.
We've got to all do the right thing if we want to cut down on those interactions with bears. We're going to go back to the phones. Larry's calling us for from Rochester. Good morning, Larry.
Hey, good morning. A couple of interesting things. I've read if you ever come face to face with a bear, look right in their eyes. Don't look down, because if you look down, that means you're afraid. And if you stare them in the eye, they'll invariably back off. But there was an article in Reader's Digest, I want to say a little over a year ago, about a gentleman that went into Western Canada on a fishing trip. He went solo. And that night he was setting up his lean-to, and he happened to look, and this over 400-pound bear, black bear, was standing about nickel and dime, about 100 feet from him. And so the guy was a little concerned, but he kept working on his tent, and the bear stayed there. And that night he went out and built a campfire and did some cooking, and the bear stayed right there. And the guy went to bed that night, and when he got up the next morning, the bear was there. And so he grabbed his fish pole and headed towards a stream, which was some distance from where he had set up his lean-to. The bear followed him, and as the guy caught fish, he was tossing fish to the bear. The bear was eating them. That night, he walked back to his campsite. The bear followed him back, and the bear sat beside him at the campfire. And the guy gave him some food, and in the course of the bear stayed with him for 2 weeks, and in the course of that time, they actually wrestled together, and the bear ended up going into the lean-to and sleeping with him, and never harmed him. And then this one morning he woke up, and the bear was outside doing some serious sniffing. And so the guy watched the bear, and all of a sudden the bear ran off out of sight and never came back. But what an interesting story. And then another quick story. There's an apartment house not far from where I live, and this guy came home one afternoon, late afternoon. It was a beautiful sunny day, and he laid down in a chaise on the deck and closed his eyes, and momentarily he felt something. He opened his eyes, and it was a bear sniffing of his chest. He let out a hoot and all, startled him so, and the bear ran off the deck, knocking chairs over every which way, and disappeared. But
well, Larry, thanks for those stories. Forrest, I'm going to say that that story in Canada is not something you'd recommend for most of us to do as far as feeding and inviting the bear into the lean-to.
Yeah, I find it a little bit chilling, tell you the truth, because mm-hmm. Bears are not domestic animals. They're wild animals. And although it's very seldom that bears actually attack or can kill people, it does happen. And some of the largest numbers of that across the country have occurred to people who've been feeding those bears. Anybody who feeds bears at their home and does it routinely, they have incidents of the bears trying to break into their home, coming into the food source. Mm-hmm. And a bear inside a house with someone where they suddenly feel trapped can be very, very dangerous. Yeah. To me, it's a little bit chilling. I will say that we do not think in most cases that bears are particularly dangerous. But at the same time, that's why we want people to report incidents of bears coming into their backyard and getting food and causing problems, so that myself and our staff of game wardens can evaluate those reports for how much risk there is to people. One of our goals is to keep people safe so that we can live with bears and not have people getting injured. We've been lucky in that regard. The only two people I know of that have been hurt by bears in the last 20 years in Vermont have actually been two separate people who were feeding bears at their home and been warned to stop, but they kept feeding bears anyway.
And the black bear, I believe, Forrest, if you do encounter one, you do not want them near. Loud noises tends to scare them off. Am I right about that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, black bears evolved as being one of the smaller bears and not the biggest predator on the landscape. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually pretty timid and runs when it's startled. It runs away from people, often climbs a tree. Unlike the other two larger species of bear in North America, which when startled will actually charge people. So in some ways, we're lucky not to have polar bears and brown bears in Vermont.
Yeah. Let's talk about bear meat. I know it's not something most Vermonters get a chance to sample, but what is it comparable to?
You know, we compare it to the preparation of it. We compare it to pork, that it should be prepared about the same way. Bear can have parasites, just like pigs have been known to have. And it has a little stronger flavor than, say, venison does, which more people are used to eating deer meat. And so it takes a little special preparation. But there are people who purposely hunt for bears and hope to get one year after year just for the meat.
Yeah.
And know how to prepare it, and it's very good. And because most people haven't tried it, and we would like to maintain a good number of bear hunters in the state, on our website we put a lot of recipes for preparing bear meat. So if people do happen to take one, then indeed they can cook it and have good luck with that meat.
I've had it at some wild game suppers in different ways, and I would say it's about the richest roast beef I've ever tasted in my life. It's just delicious. Forrest Hammond, what are some important dates for 2021 for bear hunting?
Well, important dates would be, again, when most of the bears come out of hibernation. That's important for me because I start getting the reports and people reporting damage and asking for advice. So that's usually around April 1st, but the bears certainly can come out earlier. If we lose our snowpack and have warm weather, the males come out first. And if they were able to get a good food source in your neighborhood last year, that's probably the first place they're going to be in the springtime. You know, the other important date for us, of course, is the beginning of the hunting season, which is every year on September 1st.
Gotcha. Forrest Hammond is a bear biologist for Fish and Wildlife. Hey, thank you so much for being with us today, Forrest.
Hey, I enjoyed it.
So did I. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to discuss a proposed bill that would address systemic racism and BIPOC land access. That's on Vermont Viewpoint here on WDEV.
Here we are into January, still in a pandemic, but there is hope on the horizon. At the Warren Store, renovations are wrapping up. The new deli is rocking hard with old favorites and new menu items like French fries. The grab-and-go dinners are to die for, delicious, generous, full-course meals. Check out our website, warrenstore.com, for daily offerings. Upstairs, we have a new look in the ladies' department and, wait for it, heat and air conditioning. Still fun, friendly, and funky. Main Street, Warren Village. New hours, 7:30 to 5 o'clock daily.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. The Vermont legislature will spend a lot of its time and energy focused on helping the state and Vermonters to get through the rest of the pandemic and then rebound from its effects. But the House and Senate will also spend time looking at other bills to address areas where some in the state need help. One of those is a piece of legislation called the BIPOC Land Access and Opportunity Act. BIPOC is Black, Indigenous, and Other People of Color. Among those working to advance this bill are with me today. Kenya Lazuli is founder of Radical Imagination. Kenya, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi. Stephan Gillum is president of the Windham County NAACP. Stephan, welcome to you.
Hi, glad to be here.
Great. And Brian Cena is a progressive state representative from Burlington. And Brian, it's great to have you as well.
Hi, and just so people know, it's Brian Cena.
Cena, I'm sorry. Thank you so much.
Sorry.
I'm glad you caught me early on. Thank you, Brian. This is the first time we've met, so I appreciate that. And listeners, if you've got a question about the bill, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Brian, what is the act proposing?
Basically, what we are proposing is that the state take action to increase land access and opportunity for Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. Just one thing I wanted to say in response to the intro is we don't view this bill as being other than the COVID legislation. That when the legislature meets, we have tremendous problems to address related to this pandemic. What the pandemic did, though, is it exacerbated the existing problems of our economic system. It exacerbated the disparities and inequities for all people in Vermont. And people who working in poor Vermonters are struggling more than they were before this pandemic, not only because of the pandemic, but also because of the very way our economic system has been structured. And Black, Indigenous, and other people of color have faced worse disparities through the pandemic because of the way that the system is structured. So we don't view the bill as being other. We actually view it as being part of the package to have a economic recovery from this pandemic that works for all Vermonters, not just a few.
And Kenya, what is the bill specifically proposing?
The bill is proposing that the state create a fund that would support Black and Indigenous and people of color in accessing land. Specifically with mortgages and low interest rates potentially, and the project that is near and dear to my heart is the Everytown Project, which is an effort to place at least one quality parcel of land in every town in the state in trust with the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust for permanent BIPOC access and stewardship.
And Stephan, how would this be administered? How would the bill, once it becomes, you know, an act, how would it work?
So that is still under consideration, but what we do believe would happen would be that a board of some sort will be created, and it would be BIPOC-led, and folks who were interested in participating within this Land Access and Opportunity Act would have access and availability to come before the board. And so that board really would be a governing body.
Now, Brian Cena, where do you see the funding for this coming from?
It's a good question. When we were planning this bill, we considered how we were asking for an appropriation from the state, and often when you do that, you try to identify a revenue source. But we actually made a decision, we meaning myself, Kenya, and Stefan, that as BIPOC proposing the idea, that perhaps our white allies in the legislature could do the work of coming up with the revenue stream and not having that labor and that responsibility be on BIPOC. That the economic system that we live in was built on land that was stolen, and it was built on the backs of enslaved people from Africa. And even though Vermont says that it was the first state to ban slavery, slavery is still allowed under our Constitution. And the Vermont economy, the wealthy elite of Vermont, their fortunes were built on the backs of slaves in other states. So we have to be honest about that. And so we decided we were not going to do the work of trying to scrounge for the money where this comes from. We were going to ask our colleagues in the legislature to do that work. Ultimately, I would say that it should come from the general fund, and then the state should look at taxation system and look at how do we gather that revenue from the people who should be paying for it, that this burden shouldn't fall on those in Vermont who are struggling, that the revenue should be raised as an overall plan to tax those who have benefited from the system over the last 400 years.
And, Brian, do you have an idea of how much money is needed for this to be successful, this program?
I couldn't say how much money is needed for it to be successful. I could say that we're asking for a number, knowing that that has to be negotiated. And in the end, knowing that the way state government works and how it's an incrementalist system that's built on compromise, that what we're asking for is a high goal. No, our expectations are more realistic.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, I would say that I would see it successful if the state invested any amount of money in this kind of work, because right now we're not doing it.
How much are you asking for initially?
We're still trying to work to settle on a number. So I'm hesitant to put it out there
and
have it change in a week.
We're
talking about millions of dollars. Just to give people out there a ballpark figure, millions of dollars is what we're asking for out of a multi-billion-dollar state budget that gives millions and millions of dollars to all other kinds of initiatives and has for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. Kenya, how much would be available to an individual for a down payment through this program?
So we're not exactly sure on numbers yet. I mean, we have language in there about 100% of a down payment to 50% of a down payment to 20% of a down payment. It really depends on need and other resources available to individuals. And it's not just, the fund isn't just to support individuals. It's also for groups applying together and people who want to live in community with one another.
Mm-hmm. Stefan, do you see it that these grants would be enough to purchase a home, purchase land, in addition to just being a down payment? How far do you see this going?
So we haven't had a concrete discussion about that as of yet, but at the moment we are thinking about how to proactively approach home and land ownership and access. And when we say ownership, and the reason why I kind of pause there is because ownership is different in different communities. And so in some communities, that might be a sort of stewardship where you never actually own the land. And in other communities, they might look at it as ownership where it's passed down through through generations. And so that's a hard question to answer. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that the board itself wants to create, or whatever governance structure, we don't have an official date for it yet, but whatever governance structure is created would be able to kind of parcel out. But right now, we really are focused on the lending access portion, where folks would be able to have money available to actually purchase land or home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where we're at. So I'm hesitant to speak on that. I don't want us to get ahead of ourselves.
That's fine. Yeah, I understand. That's a lot of times with bills that are proposed, especially when we're speaking early in a session, early in a new biennium. I do want to make that point that tends to be the case. There's an idea, and it really starts to get more of the meat on the bones. But this is kind of the general idea, and I appreciate those answers, Brian. Where did the idea come from?
The idea came from me and Stefan actually talking originally about this issue of wealth disparity and how despite Africans being on this continent for 400 years, that the descendants of slavery still face this massive wealth disparity, and looking at why. And one thing we recognized was part of it was access and ownership of land and the barriers that have been placed by the system. Where enslaved people, in Reconstruction, there was this notion that there was going to be sort of land and opportunity for wealth given, and that was quickly taken away by Jim Crow and other systems that played out all across the country and have really kept black people in particular in a difficult position for acquiring wealth and passing that on intergenerational. And we were recognizing the role land plays in that. That evolved into us talking about this idea of having some kind of grants for people to get into home ownership or land ownership, Then we met Kenya, which was a wonderful connection, because Kenya is doing this other great work that she could speak more about regarding collective land ownership. And we've merged the ideas. And just to go back to a previous question you had about the structure, I think the idea may not be totally finished and detailed yet, but the structure, the skeleton we're working with, is we're creating a fund. We're putting money in the fund. We're creating a board of like 15 people representing all different expertise, as, and making sure we have Black, Indigenous, and other people of color as that board, the majority, if not the entire board. And then empowering that board to give the money out based on a set of criteria. And I think the details of that is what we're still trying to figure out. But that's the basic idea, that it's a board administering a fund to address this underlying fundamental issue, which is wealth disparity for Black, Indigenous, and other people of color.
Stefan, I want to ask you, are you hoping to help BIPOC individuals who are currently living in Vermont, or to attract them from other parts of the country to Vermont?
So, first and foremost, that's a great question. I would say that, of course, we want to prioritize those who've already been living here, who've already been working hard to make Vermont their home for several years or even a short amount of time. But at the same time, we definitely want to appeal to people from outside of Vermont, you know, folks in the surrounding areas, people maybe even in the south or west, or coast. And tell them that Vermont is, and show them too, that Vermont is a place that welcomes and has laid out opportunities specifically for them. I think if we work towards creating a more diverse ecosystem in Vermont, something that, you know, not only are two representatives to the federal government, but most members and lawmakers that we have in our Vermont State House espouse to, that we have to create that ecosystem, and we have to create the pathways for that to happen. And I would also add that land ownership comes with a certain ethos. It comes with a certain pride. And I, and if any of your listeners are landowners, big or small properties, then they know what I'm talking about. And that really does draw folks, and it spoke here as well.
Kenya, you mentioned early in our discussion a couple organizations or programs, and I'd really like you to tell us more about Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust and Everytown.
Sure. So Everytown is Vermont-based specifically, and it's, the, like I said before, the goal of getting at least one quality parcel of land in Vermont in, from each town in permanent trust with the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust. So I don't work for the Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust, but I'm a network member of their listserv and their group. And they're already doing this work. They're already accepting land donations and holding it permanently for BIPOC youth with stewardship and access. And the specifics of that language is to avoid the language of ownership, because ownership of land is not a part of everyone's culture. And there's a lot more information to be had about both groups, both organizations, but I would recommend looking them up on their site. NEFOC.org is NEFOC. And the Everytown Project doesn't have a website yet. We're like still in the process of figuring out the language of our collaboration. But I recommend people definitely get in touch with them if there are land or resources otherwise that you want to donate towards this kind of work.
And again, that was NEFOC.org, correct?
Yep.
Okay, great. Brian, is this a one-off program, or do you see this continuing for several years?
I see this as a multi-year project that's interconnected with racial and social equity work in general for our state, that we need to take a long, hard look at the economic system that we are in and how, who has been the winners and who've been the losers. And that goes beyond racial and social, you know, equity. Well, racial and social equity includes people of all different economic backgrounds. So we need to look at the big picture, and this bill fits into that. What this bill does is it looks at one specific piece. It looks at land access and ownership for BIPOC, an area where we have not done good enough. And if we do it right, we can create opportunities for BIPOC to
to own land and farms, either as individual owners or collectively, and to pass that on to their future generations, which would help the economy of our state, create greater stability. But that fits into bigger work around racial and social equity that needs to happen in other areas. Like, we need to look at other forms of economic development for BIPOC. We need to look at disparities in the health system. We need to look at criminal justice issues. So I see this work going on over the next few decades, to be honest, as part of bigger work around racial and social equity, and ultimately as part of bigger work about how do we move our state and our country from an extractive economy that has been built on exploited labor and on injustice to a regenerative economy that makes sure that all people have access and opportunity to the things in life, you know, that sort of that everyone should be able to enjoy, you know, like economic prosperity, having a home, not having to worry about your health care, not having to worry about your children's safety, et cetera. So I do see this as a multi-year project, and I see this work as not happening in a vacuum, but happening as an overall effort.
Stefan, how do we change the mindset that continues to perpetuate racism in our communities?
Well, I think that question could be answered a couple different ways. But one answer that we've always known was, at least sort of correct, was integration of some sort. But in order for there to be integration, and I don't mean integration that is unethical or, unequitable either. I mean, like, true integration where everybody has a opportunity to be true neighbors and to experience each other's cultures in a way that is empowering, in a way that uplifts each other, that we can start to change minds. I think that Vermont for a long time has been isolated in a lot of ways. And even though there are a lot of good people here who I think would make good neighbors to a diverse set of individuals, they really haven't gotten that chance. And so when you don't know someone or just know someone's culture, it's really easy to utter them, even if it's not intentional. And so I think that's one piece, and I think that's kind of what you know, could be an unattended but a really happy consequence of some of this bill. And so that's just one thing. But I also said this on another interview a while back. I do believe that we are looking at the gradual fall of supremacy or supremacist culture or ways of thinking as an ideology in the United States. And as we continue to beat that back and beat that ideology back for our collective benefit, I think that you know, we can use opportunities like this bill allows to create new streams of communication and new ways of engagement. And in Vermont, that's a big deal. That's a big thing. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the isolation here has, I think it's led to a bit of, I don't want to say miscommunication, but a bit of isolationism.
Yep.
The way that we do things and we do something.
We're almost out of time. I do want to get kind of an update on where this stands, Brian. Has it been introduced as a bill, or where are we so far with this?
This has not been introduced yet. Where we're at in our timeline is that we are currently including other Black, Indigenous, and other people of color into the process of sort of final details of the bill. Then we're trying to get that done this week, and then over the next week, I'm going to start vetting the bill by my legislator colleagues and acquiring some co-sponsors, getting people to sign on to the bill, and then I'm hoping to introduce the bill in the first week of February. I mean, looking at the timeline I just presented to you,
mm-hmm.
That's kind of where we're at. And I just think it was unintended, but it's interesting that it will happen to be Black History Month when the bill gets introduced.
Oh, excellent. And today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Yeah. So excellent time to have you all on. That's Brian Chena, Progressive State Representative from Burlington. We also were talking with Kenya Lazuli, co-founder of Radical Imagination, and Stefan Gillum, president of the Windham County NAACP. Thank you all for being on with me this morning. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs, directed by Danny McGivergan, and our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.